I'm an alcoholic. My name is Alan Vanek. And I want to first, I want to thank the Speaker Committee for offering me this privilege tonight to share with you. It's always a privilege to do anything in or for Alcoholics Anonymous. Not only was that the way I was taught, that's part of my belief system today, too. I'll give you the short form tonight. When I say I'm grateful to God and Alcoholics Anonymous, that means you people, people like you in rooms like this, because without you, I wouldn't be able to be standing here tonight. And when I say God, well, that's one of the biggest miracles on the face of this earth as far as I'm concerned. You know, if you can picture a 9 or 10 year old kid trying to go to sleep at night, pulling the covers up over his head in bed and crying because the old man came home drunk one more time. Mom and dad are in the other room and they're arguing and fighting. And the kid is saying, please God, don't let him hit her. You hear that? You know what it was? That was God going out that window. And I lived over 40 years of my life like that. Thanks to people like you in rooms like this, that changed. And I was kind of a late bloomer. I only drank a few times in my late teens. The common denominator was the few times I drank, I got drunk every time. I didn't really start getting into my drinking until I was around 24 years old. But that's one of the phenomenons of this disease we have. It doesn't make any difference how much a person drank or how long a period they drank for. It's what it did to us. That's the bottom line. It's the effect it had on us. You know, I wound up going to my first AA meeting in 1973. I was a victim of circumstance. I was in the wrong place at the wrong time on the 405 freeway, and that rotten highway patrol car pulled me over and they hauled me in for a DUI. And because I'd had a previous one in 1967, at that time the window in California was second in seven, and they pull your driver's license and you go to jail, and you know, the fine is pretty severe because in 1973 they were starting to get a little more serious about it. So I talked to the ADA, and by getting a copy of the transcript from that first DUI, they threw that one out, and I was charged with a first offense. And part of the deal was I was supposed to go to 12 Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. The deal was one meeting a week. So being a good alcoholic, you know what I did? I waited until the seventh day, the end of the week, and then go into panic. Oh, I gotta go and get this card signed. I gotta go to a meeting and get a card and get it signed. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I looked them up in the phone book, and they sent me to the meeting that was closest to where I lived. And I mean, I knew the name Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't know anything about it. And I showed up at this meeting, and bad enough it was a men's stag. But then on top of that, it was a closed meeting, and it was a big book study. And those 30 or 35 guys in that room might as well have been speaking Russian, because I didn't get a thing. I didn't understand a darn thing that was going on. So I got that card signed and I got out of there. But I did manage to get a directory. Somebody gave me a directory that night, and I found another meeting. And I didn't like that one. And I found another one. And I hit the jackpot. The guy that signed my card had a real nice signature. A sixth grade kid could have copied it. And I can admit that now, because that was many, many years ago. I went to actually five meetings. I went back to that meeting one more time just to make sure of the guy's signature. And then I just copied it, and after 3 months, I turned it into the court and went on about my merry way, because, see, I didn't belong there. I wasn't an alcoholic. I didn't belong there at all. The fact that in 1975, I spent 20 days as a guest of the Orange County Department of Mental Health with what they classified as an emotional breakdown, and all it was the result of coming off of being hung over 9 out of 10 days to getting involved with a lady that had 5 kids and didn't like drinking, and I was lucky to squeak a six-pack in 1 week let alone a quart a day. And I got real nervous and I finally snapped. And one of the counselors in there was a recovering alcoholic with 10 years of sobriety. And 19 of the 20 days I was in there, this guy was real good with those little zingers, those little one-liners, two-liners, like just casually mention, "Hey, Alan, how much did you say you drank? How often were you hungover? How often did you drink?" You know, that kind of garbage. It just irritated me, you know, because I knew I wasn't an alcoholic. And I wound up in a jackpot at the end of 1976. Beginning of 1977, I wound up on 3 years formal probation. Just missed a five-year vacation on the state of California. And that was only by luck, a good attorney, and I can look back on it now, and I know God was working in my life then, too. But I had to go see this probation officer once a week. The first time I met him, I didn't know which one of us was going to kill the other first. This guy had a real nasty attitude. And he walked me into the bathroom with a paper cup. And then he handed me a couple of phone numbers, and he told me, he said, "You have to be involved in some kind of a program before you come back and see me next week." So I called one of the phone numbers, and it was Northridge Hospital, where I was living in the San Fernando Valley. And after talking to this lady for about 10 minutes, we finally hit on some common ground. They had an outpatient program. It was group rap for an hour and a half on Tuesday, 2 hours classroom on Thursday, and it wasn't going to cost me anything, and it was going to keep that nasty PO off my back, so I said, I can do that. It was called Program for Problem Drinkers. See, it didn't say alcoholic. Problem drinker. Well, I was starting to finally think about it a little bit, that maybe I did have a little problem with the drink once in a while. In reality, the only problem I had with the drink was once I took one, I didn't know what was going to happen next, and neither did anybody else. I was completely unpredictable. So I showed up for this group the first night. It went real well. I was the new kid on the block. They didn't pick on me. When it ended, the other two dozen people in the room picked up their folding chair and went out the door. And I asked the counselor, I said, "We supposed to put our chairs away?" And she said, "Oh no, they're going to the AA meeting downstairs." And I could tell you, I must have got a look on my face, because this poor lady actually took a half a step back and said, "Oh, you don't have to go, that's not part of it." But something in the back of my mind kicked in and said, "Hey, if you don't want to listen to these yo-yos day after tomorrow, where were you, why weren't you there, and that kind of manure, you better just go down there." And I did, and it was a speaker participation meeting, and that's all I can tell you about it. I didn't fall asleep. I sat in the back row and did my best to stay awake, and I did the same thing the next week. And then the third week there, something very funny happened. Possibly it was 3 weeks with no alcohol in my system, and my mind might have been starting to clear a little bit. And maybe I might have heard a couple of things at those other two meetings and not even realized it. But the guy that was talking that night, he told a war story, we'd laugh, thought it was real funny, and my brilliant mind would tell me, "Hey, Alan, you didn't do anything like that, you can't be an alcoholic." And he told another funny story, and I laughed real hard and thought it was really funny, and my head said, "See, Alan, you never did anything like that either, of course you're not an alcoholic." But he stopped talking about his war stories, the things that he did when he was drinking, and he started talking about the motivation behind his drinking. And here was a total stranger that I had never seen before in my life telling me how I really felt about Alan deep down inside. I never felt like I quite fit in, and that's what this guy was talking about. He always felt like the guy on the outside looking in, or the proverbial square peg trying to get into the round hole, until he found alcohol. And that was me. He told me about me. And when I went home from the meeting that night, the lady I was married to asked me, she says, "Well, how did it go?" And I said, it went okay. And she said, "You all right? You got a funny look on your face." And I said, yeah. I said, "You know what?" She says, "What?" I said, "I'm an alcoholic." And she looked at me and she says, "Thank God, you SOB, we've been trying to tell you that for 6 months. While her and I had run off to Las Vegas to get married, her girlfriend that had introduced us was going to her first AA meeting getting sober. And this gal was 12-stepping me by mail because my wife would call her and cry about how much I was drinking. And she tried 12-stepping me by mail. You know, she mailed some of those pamphlets out to the house, and I remember tearing them up in a rage and throwing them out. And then that broad had the audacity to send a Bic book out to the house, too. And that went flying across the room. But something changed that night. And I started going to some AA meetings other than that one. And I started getting involved a little bit. I became secretary of a meeting and secretary of another meeting. And I was asked to go on the board of directors of the Alano Club in Canoga Park. And I was asked to join the board of directors of a guy's recovery house and then a women's recovery house. And I tell you, I was strutting around by 1979. I'm strutting around like this, like, look at me, I'm Mr. AA. And even some of the people that didn't know anything about the program would hear me talking about some of the stuff, and they'd say the same thing. They used to say, there's Mr. AA. And I moved from the Valley down to Orange County the end of 1980 and kind of got away from the meetings a little bit. Then I found an outside interest that took up all my time, and I quit going to the meetings. I think over a period of about 5 years, I don't think I went to 3 meetings. And the 3 I went there only to pick up a chip for an anniversary. And then in 1986, that lady finally had enough of me. My behavior was getting more and more bizarre, more and more antisocial, and much more anger coming out. And when I blew my stack, they heard me a block away. I'm grateful I never took that anger and rage out on another human being. It was tables, chairs, and lamps and things like that. But she sent me packing. And this horrible thought came into my mind, and the thought was, where am I going to find her again? And the thought about going to a bar looking for a girlfriend was intimidating because I hadn't been in a bar in 9 years. And my brilliant mind helped me out. It said, hey, yeah, there's chicks at AA. And I started going back to the AA meetings in 1986 for the wrong reason. And I hung around there for a while, got what I went back there for, got a girlfriend for a while. And wound up getting married again in 1988. Went to a few meetings in between here and there. April of 1990, at a place called Serenity Hall in Anaheim, California, I stood up at the birthday meeting at the end of the month and I took a chip for 13 years of sobriety. And I felt guilty taking it because deep down inside I knew I didn't earn it, I didn't deserve it, and it wasn't real sobriety. And give or take a few weeks, 6 weeks later, I was dead drunk because I blew up again one night. I got very angry and upset about something, and I blew up, only this time nobody knew I was mad. Nobody knew of anything changed because I blew up inside, and there was no outside expression, and there was a liquor store 300 feet away, and I crawled back into a bottle of vodka. You know, you hear it said in the meetings about if somebody shares something they did in their drinking days and you can honestly tell yourself, I never did that, they tell you to put a yet after it. I can tell you I personally experienced some of those yets. By the way, you know, this isn't a pop quiz, but anybody heard me say anything about a sponsor or about any steps? See, 13 years, I never got a sponsor. My brilliant mind told me I was doing okay the way it was, and why clutter up my life with a sponsor? And my head told me the same thing about the steps. It was great. If you needed that crutch, good for you. My head told me I didn't need it, that it was going okay. My head told me everything was fine, and I didn't need that in my life. And that just goes to show you, my head can be my worst enemy. I stayed without drink a good portion of that 13 years with ego. Because I admitted I was an alcoholic and I didn't drink. And that made me better than you. That made me better than the rest of the people. And it finally caught up with me. And I went back out, and it'd be nice if I could say, you know, I got drunk and came back a couple days later. It took me over 2 years to get back. And those yets I talked about, I never used to be a morning drinker. I couldn't drink first thing in the morning. I had to have my coffee. and it was usually a pot or a pot and a half of coffee, and 3 hours later before I'd touch a drink, sometimes 4 or 5 hours later. In less than 6 months, it was the hell with the coffee, out the door, 6:30, whatever time in the morning when I got up, out the door and hit the liquor store and get my orange juice. 50-50, orange juice, vodka. Another thing I had a phobia on because of the laws that they had in California, I didn't even want to have an empty bottle or an empty beer can in my car, let alone one with something in it. And the same thing, in 3 or 4 months, 75% of the time that I was in my car, I had a drink going. It didn't matter if the car was sitting still in the parking lot or if I was driving down the street. And I thought, oh, nobody's gonna notice, nobody's gonna trip on it. It's just orange juice. And the biggest part of the insanity was the car I was driving was a wide open roadster. You could see right into it. And it was a very low car. I mean, a guy could pull up next to me in a Volkswagen and tell you what color my shoes were. And I carried on like that. And then I started having this other little difficulty. I was having these time lapses. You know, it was great. I'd go after work, stop at the bar after work, and then all of a sudden happen to look up at the clock. I'm like, wait a minute, I got there, it's 5:30. Now it's midnight. I just lost track of time because I was having fun. But then I look around and, wait a minute, I was drinking at Charlie's. What am I doing at the Rainbow Room? When did I get here? How did I get here? I don't know. You know, those little things we call blackouts. I had some beauties. Somebody told me a few years back, somebody told me I could have been a poster child for Mothers Against Drunk Drivers because I drank and I drove in and out of blackouts. I lost miles and hours. I was just very fortunate in one of those blackouts that I never hit anything or anybody, or I might not be standing here tonight either. I'm in a bar one night, and I'm getting wasted, and I see this guy walk through the door. It's about 10:30 on a Sunday night, and I thought I recognized him from Serenity Hall, and I went over and said something to him, and I said, hey, didn't you used to go to Serenity Hall? And he gave me a dirty look, and he says, yeah, I still do. And he didn't recognize me at first, because when he met me, my hair was a lot different than what it is now. So I covered the hair up, and I said, Alan, remember? And he says, oh, I wondered what happened to you. What are you doing? And I just held the glass up and says, I'm having a drink. And he said, oh, I'm sorry to see that. And we talked for a few minutes, and he went on about his business. The reason he came in there, he and his sponsor had opened a video store with a very large adult section. And he was going around passing out flyers with discount coupons at the bars trying to drum up business. About 3 weeks later, I'm in the same bar. It's around 10 o'clock at night. I've been there since 1 o'clock in the afternoon, so you know the kind of shape I was in. And I see him come through the door, and I didn't want to deal with it, and I did a 45-degree turn to the right. And he saw it when he came through the door. And he came over, and he's a big guy. He's about 6'2". He came over and he gave me a little nudge with his elbow, and he said, I saw you turn away when I came through the door. And I said, yeah. And he leaned over me and pointed at the glass, and he said, well, I see you're still at it, huh? And I looked at him with all the drunken sarcasm I could find, and I said, yeah, so what? What are you, my freaking conscience? And he got this real somber, soft look on his face. He said, no, just somebody that cares, and you know where we are when you're ready. And with that, he turned around and walked out before I had a chance to say anything. And that really ticked me off. About 4 weeks after that, hit the bar after work. I'm sitting in the bar. It's after 11 o'clock. I'm drinking vodka tonic, and I should have had a good buzz going. You know, I've been there for 5 hours. I should have had a good buzz going. And I couldn't feel anything. It was like I was in a vacuum. And the pool table was going, the jukebox is going, I'm sitting down the other end of the bar drinking by myself like I usually did. And the thought went through, what's going on, you know? I felt weird. And I happened to see my reflection in the mirror behind the bar. And this, this god-awful thought went through my mind, and the thought was, what the hell am I doing here? And my brilliant mind helped me out one more time. And my mind said, I'm an alcoholic, and alcoholics drink, and damn it, I have a right to be here. And with that, I grabbed the glass and took another belt. And it was a fairly fresh vodka tonic. And when I tell you that it tasted like a glass of tap water that had been sitting out on the table for 2 or 3 days, I'm not exaggerating. I still even remember looking at the glass, wondering if somebody was playing games and switched drinks on me, and that was my drink. And this horrible thought went through my mind, and the thought was, oh my God, it ain't working. And I just shook my head, and I shoved the drink away, and I walked out of there and left a half a drink behind. That's the only time I consciously remember leaving an unfinished drink behind in my life. I left, I went home, went to sleep, got to work in the morning, and as I walked through the door, the girl that worked with me tells me, you got a call waiting, and it was a friend of mine that I had met in sobriety. We had worked together. He relocated back to New York. And the conversation started out when I said, hi, how you doing? He said, well, this is the phone call I never wanted to make and probably the one you never wanted to get. And I said, why? What's up? And he said, well, I understand you're drinking. And I, yeah. And he said, what, are you crazy? I said, I don't know, Clive, maybe I am. We talked for about an hour. Finished the conversation, and I called someone I knew that had 11 months in the program that didn't know the shape I was in. And made arrangements to go to a meeting with that man that night. That was July 17th, 1992. After the meeting, we went out and had coffee and pie and stuff. And then I got in the car and I drove over to Anaheim, over to that video store. And I walked in there, and it was about 12:45 in the morning on a Friday night. And Leo sees me coming through the door, and he does his, crosses his arms, and he plants his feet, and he looks, and he says, oh, what's up? And I just shook my finger in his face, and I said, hey, before you say anything, I want you to know I just came from a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He looked, and he said, so what? I said, well, I said, do you remember a few weeks ago when I asked you if you thought you were my conscience? And he said, yeah. I said, well, on the way over here tonight, I made a decision to promote you from conscience to sponsor. Got even with him. You know, that goes with another joke you hear around AA that we joke about in AA, about be careful what you say to that newcomer. He might be your sponsor someday. I met this guy, Leo, Thanksgiving Day, 1987, his first day sober. And here we are, roll forward to 1992, July. And I just appointed him my sponsor. See, I've been in sales and marketing most of my life, and that was an old reflex that kicked in. And the reflex was, if you ask someone, will you, they can say no. And my subconscious knew I couldn't have handled a no. So I just flat-ass told him he was my sponsor. He said, well, what are you going to do now? Are you done? And I looked at him, and I just looked down at the floor and threw my arms in the air and said, Leo, I just can't go anymore. And he said, okay, meet me at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning at Serenity Hall, and we'll take it from there. And he said, and don't drink between now and then. And that's what I did. I met him the next morning, and we started working on step one. I had a little problem with step two. I told you earlier why. And he told me, he says, well, is this meeting, this group of power greater than you? I said, yeah. He said, all right, that'll do for now. But a couple of months sober, he started leaning on me and telling me, you know what, if you don't get a higher power, your own understanding, you're going to be back out there. And if that's what you want to do, then get out of my face right now. I don't need to waste my time. And I was so desperate, I just said, okay, what do I do? He said, pray about it. And I said, I don't know how. How? And he said, well, you could start by getting down on your knees at night when you go to bed. I said, all right, then what do I do? You know, I'm flashing back to some visits I'd had to the Catholic Church back in the 70s and the 60s, and couldn't get a grasp on that. and this born-again Christian church I went to with that one ex-wife, I couldn't get a grasp or a grip on what they were doing either. And I'm flashing back to that, and I said, I don't know what to pray. And he said, you know, he said, pray to whatever. And I said, what do you mean pray to whatever? He said, he said, sometimes you're so dense. He said, you could say something as goofy sounding as, hey, whatever, I need some help with the spirituality gig. And I said, okay, I guess I can do that. And I did, and a couple of things happened over the next few weeks that I couldn't completely analyze or explain. And when I start telling him about the one occurrence, he said, so what do you think happened? I said, well, I did this and this is. He says, yeah, I know. And then what happened? And I said, I don't know. And all he did was point up and he said, when are you going to wake up? And I started to believe just a little bit that day, just about that much that day. But what helped me, once I got to that point, what helped me, I started paying a little more attention to the people in the meetings. And I believed because they believed. I figured not all of the people in that room could be wrong. Maybe a few of them were a little out there, but not all of them could be wrong. And I believed because they believed. And over the years, I've been able to build on that. And there is absolutely no shadow of a doubt in my mind today that God has a plan for me. All I have to do is do the footwork, stay out of his way, and leave the results up to him. You know, Leo and I worked together. We worked, got through that third step, started working on that fourth step, and I was dragging my ass on that for a while. And I finished the first column, and then I'm stalling, and I finally, one night, I was upset about something, feeling lonely, and I said, maybe I'll work on the fourth step. And I started working on that fourth step about a little after 11 at night, and I finished it at 6:30 in the morning. It just caught fire, and I finished it. And I called him at work at 9 o'clock, and, hey, I finished my fourth step. Can we get together tonight and do my fifth step? And I'm all happy, and he said, no. I said, what the hell? I said, you've been bugging me for weeks to finish it. It's done. He said, well, I'm busy until Saturday. He said, I want you to go back and reread it. He said, maybe you left something out. And he said, we'll get together Saturday. And that's what we did. 5.5 hours in the gazebo in his backyard. And every once in a while, I'd read something to him, and I'd kind of glance over and look for body language or a reaction. And there were a couple of items that if he'd have jumped up and said, get the hell out of my house, I wouldn't have even quibbled. But indeed, he didn't do that. He even related some of his own experiences that tied in with what I had read to him. We finished that, and he sent me home to read 6 and 7 into 12 and 12, and then write it and bring it to him the next day. And I started experiencing a little bit more peace and serenity within Alan after that. And you know, a lot of people bolt out of here. They bail out on that when it comes time for the fourth step. It just, there's something about it that just drives people nuts. It just intimidates the hell out of them. Fourth and fifth are a piece of cake, folks. Wait till you get to 8 and 9. That's where the fun comes in. And I had my amends list. And you know, the first item on the amends list, there were some interesting items on there, by the way. I had the California Highway Patrol, Southern California Edison, Santa Ana Police Department, Westminster Police Department, and other things, other agencies like that. But the very first item on the list was Alcoholics Anonymous, because I felt AA gave me a damn good chance for that 13-year period from 1977 until 1990. And I literally urinated in Alcoholics Anonymous' face. And he told me, he said, that's okay to have that on there. He said, but you got to get rid of the guilt. He said, you're human, you screwed up. Okay, don't carry the guilt for that around with you. And I said, yeah, okay, but how do I make an amend to Alcoholics Anonymous? He said, by staying sober and being of service to Alcoholics Anonymous for the rest of your life, you dummy. I said, okay. And I got through the amends, but there was one on there, and that was that last wife's ex-husband. And I don't know if you remember a sitcom called The Jeffersons, when the doorman or Bentley or somebody, the neighbor would ring the doorbell, and that little panty rooster George would go over and open the door up. and see who's there, and they just and slam the door in the person's face. Don't ask me why. I've never figured out why I did this, why I acted this way. When that man came over to pick up his daughter, and I knew he'd be coming, to take her to the movies or roller skating or something, the doorbell'd ring, I'd go over and open the door, and he'd say, "I'm here too," and I'd say, "Yeah, I know," and I'd slam the door in his face. And he was a member of this fellowship too. And it finally ate at me long enough that I had to do it. And I knew he went to meetings at the Garden Grove Alano Club, and I had a friend that hung around there a lot. And I asked this lady, I said, "Hey, have you seen so-and-so?" And she said, "Oh, he moved to Arkansas." And I said, "Oh." I said, "Well, I don't know if that's good or bad." And she said, "Why?" I said, "Well, I owe him an amend." And she said, "Well, write him a letter." I said, "Oh, well, yeah, I can do that. Do you have his address?" And she said, "No." She said, "Write the letter, you idiot. Don't worry about mailing it. Just write it for now." And I called my sponsor and I asked him, and he says, "Yeah, she's right. Write the letter." And I said, "Okay, I'll do that." That was on a Tuesday. And I hadn't got around to that letter yet, but I was there Sunday for the noon speaker meeting because a friend of mine was the speaker. The meeting ended at 12:30. We chit-chat a little bit after the meeting. I'm getting ready to leave. I go out, and as I pushed the door open to go out to the parking lot, somebody outside the door grabbed the door and opened it up right in front of me. And I'll give you three guesses. My last amend. And I looked and I said, "I thought you moved to Arkansas." He said, "No, I was just there visiting my folks." And I said, "Oh." I said, "You got a few minutes? We need to talk." And he said, "Why? What's up?" I said, "I owe you some amends." He says, "Oh, no, forget it." And I said, "Hey, you know the deal." I said, "You know the program." I said, "Would you please allow me to make my amends?" And he says, "Okay." We sat down, had a cup of coffee. It took me 10 minutes to make those amends. I left there almost an hour later. The rest of the time we sat there talking and just shooting the breeze like a couple of long-lost cousins. And in my head, I was making a big deal out of that. There are no big deals in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? And like I say, I know God's got a plan for me. I just have to stay out of his way. I wound up doing another fourth step and fifth step just before I turned 3 years sober. And this one was with my sponsor and my grand sponsor. And it had to do with relationships only. And the way Mark, my grand sponsor, put it, he said, "If you can remember it, put it down. I don't care if it was a 10-year marriage or a one-night stand, put it down." And just like the fourth step, the first fourth step, it was column 1, 2, and 3. What was my part in that deal? And all of a sudden, I finished that up, and I experienced one of the greatest freedoms I've ever experienced in my life. I was comfortable being with Alan. I didn't need her in my life to validate how I felt about me anymore. I mean, I could come home from work and fix something to eat, and kick back, watch TV, or go to a meeting, then come home, watch TV. I wasn't running. I wasn't on the run anymore. And I didn't need that emotional crutch of a woman in my life anymore. And that's one of the greatest freedoms I have ever experienced in my lifetime. You know, I dated a few girls over the years then. You know, a little here and there, go to a movie, go to a meeting, go to dinner in a meeting, or whatever, nothing serious. Not looking for a relationship. I got involved with the Orange County Hospital and Institutions Committee, and I was very involved with that and with the H&I Conference. And I mean, I was doing 9 panels a month. That meant that was an average of twice a week I was in a facility taking a message into either a treatment facility or a jail or a prison. And I was all wrapped up in that. And this lady moved back down to Orange County from up north, from up the state of Washington. And my sponsor and I just wanted to make her feel welcome, you know, welcomed her to Serenity Hall, and we chit-chat and everything. Didn't make any moves, didn't even try hitting on her or anything like that. You know, we just kind of became friends. We talked before and after a meeting a little bit. I'd known her 3 months before I finally asked her for her phone number. And I got her phone number. We went on our first date December 28th, 1996. We got married February 28th, 1997. It was a long courtship. 8.5 years, folks. And she's sitting down here in the front row, so you know damn well I wouldn't say this if it wasn't true. I couldn't say this if it wasn't true. We have not had an argument. We don't always agree, We don't have to always agree. But this, what this program taught me was to allow her the dignity to say what she needs to say when she needs to say it, and not take it as a personal attack on Alan, because I'm not that important. And that's a far cry from where it was 13, 14 years ago, because it was all about me. It all evolved around me. And it was, I want what I want when I want it, damn it. And in this program, I learned that I get what I need when I need it. And there hasn't been a time in the last 13 years where I've thought I needed something and I didn't get it. And I'd realize after the fact, I could look back and say, you know, I really didn't need that. That was just a want. You know, God takes good care of me as long as I keep doing the right things. You know, participating in my recovery anytime I have the opportunity to do so. You know, I said I'd always, you know, and I believe in this. This is part of my belief system. I will go to any length to maintain my sobriety. I will do anything and everything I have to preserve my sobriety and my recovery today. Because without that, I don't have anything else. And if this, and sweating up here, if this isn't going to any lengths, I never realized the lengths were going to be this long. But it's okay. It's okay. You know, God wound up putting us here in Las Vegas. I lived in Southern California for 40 years, 30 of it in Orange County. 11 months ago, we uprooted and relocated here to Las Vegas. And that was one God shot after another. And every time, there were a number of times that I'd start questioning in my head, in my mind, is this really the right thing? Should we really be doing it? And God would drop one of those little bricks on my head and wake me up a little bit. It was just one thing after another. The people that I've met here, the way it came about, buying the houses and everything else. My wife got to realize a dream she's had for over a dozen years. She's had a dream. She's had a desire to have a sober living house for women because she loves working with the women. And she has that in her life today, thanks to this program. You know, and I could go on and on and on. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've lost my whole family. My mom, my dad, my aunt, who was like my second mother, and my best friend. They've all passed away. And that's all happened within my sobriety. I didn't have to drink over it. And I was always close to my mom. If you think God doesn't have a plan for you, like I thought I didn't think he had a plan for me for a while, I'll share one thing before I end. I was involved with H&I in Southern California, and they have a conference every year. And I thought, boy, it would really be neat, really be a privilege to chair that conference someday. And the guy that was the co-chair that was going to move up to chair the following year relocated because of his job. And I was nominated at the business meeting to be the new co-chair. The following month at the business meeting, when they were going to have their election, the policy chair read the requirements for the co-chairman. And it was, the first thing was 5 years of continuous sobriety. And the first thing went through my head was, they won't know. And my hand went up like that, because that was old thinking. And I put my hand up and I copped. I said, well, and this was the end of May. I said, I'm sorry, I won't have 5 years of sobriety until July 17th. They elected someone else. I was the only one that was nominated. They nominated and elected someone else. And I was a little disappointed. I was elected to that position 3 years later. And I was served as co-chair 1 year and chair the following year. The day before the final planning meeting for that conference, my mother passed away. And this program and what I was taught would not allow me to go hide in a closet. I wanted to crawl into a hole and pull it in after me. And I couldn't do that because of the teachings I've had in this program. I had a commitment. And I showed up for that commitment at that planning meeting the next day, and it saved me big time. See, God knew 5 years before that, God knew I was going to need that in my life at that time. I believe that with every breath in my body. You know, like I said, I love everything about this, and it's been a real privilege to be here. I thank you for being here to help me participate in my sobriety. I hope we all meet on the as we trudge the road to happy destiny. God bless you. Thanks.